starting to get a good glimpse of David. He's definitely a political figure. He knows good politics. He knows how he has to mollify the people when necessary. I'm not hereby suggesting that David only killed the Amaleki because he thought it was politically wise to make sure that no one would think he was happy with the news or anything like that. But, do you all have yours?
I have yours.
Okay, well, I'm just going to go over the few that are in the beginning of Shmuel Bet. Okay. There are just two. One is that David kills this boy on his own testimony. Torah specifically says, you shall not put to death anybody except by the testimony of two witnesses who saw it. You don't have two witnesses who saw this. This is the excuse why David doesn't get put to death for what he did with Bathsheba. I know we'll learn about the divorce, the war, but the prophet says to him, Gam Hashem hevir eschatoscho lo tamus. The simple implication of that statement is, you should. But God is going to give you a pass because he's easy to tshuva, you're contrite, whatever else. But here, why doesn't David give this benefit of this judicial procedure? So, for this, I have. Yomer David al Hanar Hamagid Lo. Emi ze atav. Yomer ben Ishgera Maliki Anochi. Nizkar David ba'osa Shoa Mashne Mar Lamosh Rabbeinu. Im Yavoa Chod Mi Kol Mos Haolam Li Tkayer Shekablu Osa. And we base so shall a molek al yukablu osa. Yad v'yomar ilav David damcha al roshcha ki picha anavach. L'kach amar midor dor. Wow, according to this Mechilta, David did not kill him because he killed Shaul. He killed him because he was an Amaleki. He wasn't Jewish, he was an Amaleki. So, this is problematic on two grounds. One, this happens not to be the halacha. Gemara paskins otherwise. Two nations that are not allowed to convert is Amon and Moab, not Amon. Right? Gemara says, and Nebon of Shalhaman, and the Torah of Nebra. Okay. Not all of Haman's sons were hanged, and some who survived turned things around. We learned that about Amaleki. Amalekim ha-chata'im. Interesting, there's Gemara in the Sechus of Odizara in Daf Yud Aleph, where Marcus Aurelius, you familiar with him? Marcus Aurelius, he's like a really good Roman emperor who was very friendly with Rebbe. There's some legends about their early childhood. But anyway, Marcus Aurelius is talking to him about, do I have a place in the next world, even though I'm a Roman? So, you know, assuming that means he's from Esav or Edom, and Rebbe keeps telling him, all the psukim you're citing me, which makes you think that you have a fate that is destined for, you know, what these prophets said about Edom. No, that's only the prophets it's only the Edomites who continue to behave like Esav. But anyone who turns away from that legacy. So it says, Ha'amalekim ha-chata'im, Shaul is enjoying to give it. So what do we do with this source? Okay, the Mechilta is indeed an important rabbinic source. Okay, it's quoted in the Gemara, it's called the Braisa. Okay, so Medrash Halacha Tishmos, you all know that, right? Do you remember which Acharon printed his Perush to the Torah with Medrash Halacha with it? Remember, I mentioned it recently. Malvin. Okay. Malvin wanted to enhance the study of Medrash Halacha by printing his work with the Medrash Halacha. Obviously not the Bereshis. There is no Medrash Halacha Bereshis. Perush Shmos is called Mechilta. Vayik was called Sifra, or Torah Kohanim. And Bamidbar and Dvarim together called Sifrei. Sifrei books, Sifra book, Why did they do it that way? Because Bamidbar and Dvarim together have about the same amount of mitzvahs as Vayikra by itself. Okay. This mechilta, not every mechilta is psak halacha. Right? Sometimes there's a conclusion drawn from the Bavli that might draw us in a different direction. Okay. Certainly to say that the only nation that's not allowed to accept converts from that nation is not a mole. It's not a mole. It's not limited, you know, it would be limited to a mole. Why did they just say only a mole? Where do you get that? Okay. So this mechilta is problematic on a number of levels. Okay. Another source, look at the Tanhuma. Now, this is also a bit problematic. He says, I am the son of Doika Adomi. Rashi quoted the Psikta that he was actually Doika Adomi. And Rashi said, that doesn't make sense. Because Doika Adomi at this time would have to be the 60s, 70s. He's called a Na'ar Amaleki. Alright, Amaleki, Edom, can we mix them up? Maybe. All of Amalek is Edom, but not all Edom is Amalek. Right? Edom is a nation, Amalek is a grandson. This is also not without its problems. Okay, but this is the son of Doik. Why are you killing him for being Doeg's son? But you remember when we learned this inside in chapter 1, when we saw that Rashi that said it's, quotes the Psikta, that it's Doeg Adomi, do you remember what the conclusion we drew from that? Is that Rashi was grappling where he doesn't get the right to kill this boy. Ah, it must be because he was someone else who deserved Chayavisa from a different direction. Like the first source here basically says, he didn't kill him for killing Shaul. How do we know he killed Shaul? Killed him because he was an Amalek. Now, what we did last class, when we did chapter 4, remember where David brought down one of the Kalachomers? I killed a guy for just being Mavaser about Shaul's death, and he thought I would like it. How much more so am I going to kill someone who thinks I'm going to like the fact that they actually killed the guy? Okay. Mechilta Amalek. Now you should know that the Mechilta's chapters are called by their various names. Mechilta the Pischa, Mechilta the Shira. There's a Mechilta called a chapter called Mechilta da Amalek. Okay? And Tanchuma Kitetse, ignore the textual basis for the Amalekite lad's alleged guilt, namely for putting the lords and lords to death. Perhaps on this basis alone, David was not justified in killing the Amalekite lad. Would you agree that that seems to be the implication of both sources I just read? Why didn't these two sources say, how did David have the right to kill him? Well, how dare he? He took the life of the anointed of the Lord. By not answering that, both sources seem to imply, stay with me, that that alone does not legally justify David to do what he did, which is what gets him in this book. Torah says not to kill someone except on the testimony to kosher witnesses. Yeah, I'll read it again. Perhaps on this basis alone, David was not justified in killing the Amalekite lad. According to Mechilta, Amalek, the lad deserved to die because he was an Amalekite, a people who are biblically doomed to death. This source teaches that even the Amalekite converts to Judaism shared his fate. Thus the violation is denied. Tanchuma Kitetse indicates that the Amalekite lad was put to death for his apparent role in the killing of priests of Nov. thus the violation is denied. Rashi cites the Psikta, which identifies the Amalek that led as the way himself, and disagrees. This source is a little different than the Psikta. It says that he killed a Doeg's son, who might be justified to call it a lad. And what I took the liberty of writing in my footnote was that the Tanhuma must feel that Doeg's son also took part in the killing of the priests of Noah. That's why he killed him. It is a footnote where I write that the Rambam in Hilchos Sanhedrin classifies David's having the Amalekite lad put to death on his own admission as Horat Shah, the special din that only a king could do. According to the other answers, anyone should have killed him, could have killed him. And I give you a series of sources that collect data about this ruling of a king having this right. Okay? That's all we'll do with this. Okay. If you recall, we discussed the evolution in Midrashim about the sort of a waning allowance of a king to go that far with his rights. Do you remember with Abigail, right? In one source, it seems to imply the Gemara Megillah that had David really been a king, he would have had the right to kill Abigail's husband. David felt he did have a din of Melech, and Abigail convinced him that he did not. The other source that we saw from Medrash Tehillim, the Shofar Tov, was that even if you're a king, you don't have the right to do this. Seems that became more enlightened in evolution of the rights that the Jewish people, the Jewish sources felt that the king has. Right? She runs out to him in that source saying, David Melech, please don't kill my husband. Why do you want to kill my husband? He goes, he acted insolently to me and I'm king. He goes, yes, you're king, yes, but please, you get it? She convinces him that he does not have that right, even as king. Okay? We're all good? Okay. That very strange description. I'm just going to close that parakeh with this because then now we have to discuss how the Aron got back to to Israel, to a centralized place. Is that David conquered the Moabites amid some trash talk? Are you familiar with that? Remember? He said even if this wall was guarded by blind and lame people, you wouldn't be able to conquer it. Who are the blind and lame? So on the face of it would mean you are at such a disadvantage that even if our soldiers were blind and lame, you wouldn't win. Okay. Maimar Chazal says that the blind and lame meaning that they were idols. And that's what it's not called then. They had their idols across the wall, like icons. You can see St. John the Divine on Amsterdam on 110th Street. They have these like 20 statues. I don't know how they reconcile that with Lo Tasel Chopes Al B'chol Tmunah, but okay. But so they had all these idols across the wall of Yerushalayim, and then it just bugged David. He said, don't let me look at these. They're blind, they're lame, their eyes cannot see, like we said this morning. We actually didn't say this morning because it was Katzihah. But, so that is what the blind and lame are, according to Mephoshim. So I would like to tell you from the basis of some archaeological data of certain ancient nations. Yavusi is not listed among them, but a way of doing battle was to hide and crouch behind blind and lame people. The enemy was faced with shooting arrows at blind and lame people, and they wouldn't, because there's no honor in that. Right? So Sforno says that the reason that Esav really wanted to kill Yaakov in Parshas Vayishlach, and he wanted to have a fair fight with him, but he decided not to when he saw him limping. Remember, he just fought with the angel. When he saw him limping, he said, "Oh, this isn't a fair fight. What are the papers going to say? Esav kills a limping brother." I don't need it. So you don't shoot at, I mean, the Arabs used to do this. They would carry a baby to the front. They continue to do this in Gaza. They shoot dafka from nurseries, from hospitals, from apartment buildings, from residences, knowing that if they want Israel to shoot back, they want the reporters to come in and take pictures of an apartment building that was taken down. They make the moon shields. So that's how the Yavusi would fight, crouching behind blind and lame people. So that now might explain why David never wanted to look at them. These other interpretations don't explain any post-traumatic stress syndrome. This was very stressful, because after some time of advancing, David just decided, shoot those arrows, guys, take out all those people in the front. They're doing it to themselves. David said, don't show me any blind and lame people anymore. Don't let them in my palace. Which might explain David's harsh treatment of Mephibosheth later. It's not a good explanation. I've heard that before. It's not good. David was very kind to Mephibosheth. Chapter 9. He turns on him later. We'll get to that. Mephibosheth was Yonatan's crippled son. Okay, that brings us to today's presentation. Perek Vav, please, anybody come up? Anybody have it? With the storyline. Okay. You start reading, how about if you get a story? Zahava, Paragvah, Pasuk Aleph, and Bet.
The Yusuf O David as called before the Israel Shloshim Aleph. Via Hamba Yelech David and Kola Amash Ritom. מבעלי יהודה להעלות משם את ארון האלוקים, אשר נקרא שם, שם השם, צפקות ושב רבים עליו.
Actually, השם נקרא שם, סתיו, because that's a רביעי, and then שם השם, צפקות ושב רבים עליו. ויוסף, according to the Targum, seems to be missing an aleph. Like Rashi says, let us sof. David gathered 330,000 בחורים. Now this is going to be some display. That's like a stadium. Right? Okay, he took people in order to bring up the Aron. Right? The famous one that had the Kruvim. Would you agree that this pasuk seems to imply that there's another one? Which Aron was it? Oh, the one with Shem Hashem Tzvakos. Vayibe Me'achashverosh. Which Achashverosh? Who are these? The Achashverosh. So if you wanted to look at a list of the 10 Persian kings, it wouldn't harm you to assume that whoever he is, there should be another king with the same name. Of those 10 kings, only 2 have a name that no one else had. Cyrus, Cambyses. But all the others multiply. There are 4 Artaxerxeses. There are 2 Xerxes and 2 Dariuses. Okay. So most historians think Ahasuerus is Artaxerxes the first or Xerxes the first. So when you have something, it seems to you get the feeling. Sometimes it's just you get the sense that this is the Aron we're talking about, but there is another one. Well, we learned that already, didn't we? Paragal. Oh, we should record it.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay. All right. So we learned that in Paragal that the Bnei Eli took the wrong Aron to war. This is the one they took to war. It was another one. And it's very mashman shmos that Moshe was told to make two arons. After the Egel, Hashem says, make an aron and put those two close in it. And then afterwards, it says, Hashem tells him that Bezalel is going to make an aron. Okay? Plus, there's really good evidence back in Perak Aleph, Shmuel Aleph, because at some points the Aron is called Aron Elokim, and other places it's called Aron Kevokim. Now, we all know what the Bible critics do with that. They say that those are two different sources that some redactor put together. If that's your only answer, then bully for you. But I have another answer. Yeah. All right, everyone ready to go to continue? Shannon, Gimel, and Dal, please. Be'er Kibu.
Be'er Kibu at Aaron Ha'alakim El Agalah Hadashari Be'isa Uhu Mibit Abinadab Asher Be'giva Ruza Be'achiel B'nei Abinadab Ha'alakim Et Ha'agalah Hadashah Be'is Sa'uhu mibi avinada v'asher v'geva im aron ha'alokim v'achira v'olet v'nei aron.
His names are very interesting. Avinadav sounds like two brothers in the story of the Torah that seems to have a very similar element to it. Someone getting a little too close to God in a certain way, and then they just something gets into their body and kills them. Right? In fact, that story, which is we're going to read in 2 weeks, it's Parsha Shmini. Right? Not in 2 weeks, more, because it's after Pesach. This is the Haftorah of that. Okay, done? So, what a coincidence that the father's name is Avinadav. And what a great kavod he got in front of 30,000 people. His son Uzzah and his son Achio got the right to walk on both sides of the arm. Some Avinadav was probably walking in the front of the arm. Okay, why him? Because Vesumi Ves Avinadav. He was in his house for 20 years. Okay? Okay, now Nechama Leibowitz has a treatise where she teaches how to teach Tanakh in high school using this story. Plus, it's rare. You probably use her studies on the Parsha, right? Studies in the Parsha. Because on Shmini, she has one of the chapters on the Haftorah. She doesn't always do that. In fact, she rarely does. Okay, so. Okay. Now, I think this came up when we discussed the Aron earlier. Remember we discussed seeing God, people of Beit Shemesh came to the Aron that was brought back when the Plishtim sent it back. And it says, Vayismuchu lirot. You saw Bilat Mancha, they came in all the parshas about getting too close to that night. Hashem tells Moshe, don't let them come up to the mountain. Pen yehersu lirot. Right? Gidon, Shimshon's parents, Yishayah. Remember, I gave you this separate page of the book. You must have it someplace here. So at the time, this came up also. Another Milat Mancha was Peretz. And you froze bum. Don't let them cross over this boundary. And you froze bum. They'll be a Peretz. The human being will chat, will overcharge his circuits. Of course, I can make any human live. I can do anything I want. But them's the rules. That's, I'm not going to break the teva of what happens when a human being crosses that line. God told Moshe, Ki lo yirani ha'adam b'chai. I tell you this because if you look at Divrei HaYamim, where this story appears, it starts off with an interesting sort of commentary. Right? The David calls together a bunch of people to bring back the Aron. Vayomer lahem, atem roshei ha'avos l'aviv, hiskatshu atem b'acheichem b'alisem es Aron Hashem Elokei Yisrael el hachinos ilo. We're going to bring up the Aron to the place I set aside for it. Now here's a key pasuk. It's Divrei Yamim Aleph Tesvav Yud Gimel 15:13. Ki lima'ba rishona. Six syllables. Ki lima'ba rishona lo atem poratz Hashem Elokeinu banu ki lo drashnu kamishpat. We haven't been searching for God the way we should. That in itself is brought about a Peretz, a breach. Okay. But what's wrong with Pasuk Gimel there that you just read, Shana? There's something terribly wrong in Pasuk Gimel. Nohagim es ha'agala chadashah. They put the Aron on a brand new wagon. I don't want to put it on a wagon that was used to cart manure or food. No, a brand new Aron. Mamish designated for this. Beautiful. What's wrong?
You're supposed to carry it.
Just carry it. It's supposed to be human on human shoulders. Na-na-na-na-na-na-na. How did David make such a mistake? Can anyone venture why this didn't get in my book? Remember, this is a book on polemics. Okay. Why isn't this in my book? The Aveira of the Torah. Can you venture an answer?
It's not relevant today.
It's a diuk because in the beginning I write that it can't violate the plain meaning of the biblical text. There is no plain meaning of the biblical text that says we can only carry the Aron on the shoulders of B'nai Kahas. Maybe that was only the case in the desert. Okay. The fact is, I submit to you that the Sefer HaChinuch and the Rambam count it as one of the 613 mitzvahs. That when the Aron is in transit, it is to be transferred on the shoulders of the Levites. But I still didn't include it. Maybe I should have had like a page or footnote or something. I didn't include it because that's not the plain meaning. In fact, the Sefer HaChinuch writes in this chapter, how did David mess up on this? And he writes, David might have thought that the mitzvah to carry them on his shoulders was only in the desert, and then when you get into the land, maybe you can carry the different one. Right? Full disclosure, let me tell you a Gemara. Maybe they'll remind you of another Gemara that sounds just like it. David in Tehillim has a pasuk that says, Zmiros hayuli kol mishpatei tzidkecha. Your mishpatim, your righteous mishpatim are like zmiros to me. Sound familiar? It's in Perikuf Yutes, chapter 119 that goes to the alphabet 8 times. One of the Zions is this. Your mitzvahs are like zmiros to me. So the Mechti Gemara in Sota says, zmiros? You're calling my like a song that you sing in the street? That you sing in the circus? What do you mean, zmiros? I'll make you forget a mitzvah that every child in grade school knows. That when you carry the aron, you have to carry it on the backs of your feet. Again, that's not the plain meaning. You know, the Sefer HaChinuch renders David's excuse. Maybe he thought that that mitzvah is only in the desert. It's not in perpetuity. Okay, clear? Does it remind you of another Gemara, by the way? That Gemara is in Sota, Daf Lamed Hei, and Daf Samach in Maseches Brachos. I think I might have mentioned it.
There's two things that's reminding me of. One is Moshe not knowing what to do.
But that happens often enough in the Torah. Right. And you know what these accompanies Moshe not knowing what to do?
Mm-hmm.
It's Rashi. No, it's a Rashi. No. He gets angry. Every time Moshe gets angry, he does something that he sort of messes up. And it's, I wouldn't say it. Rashi says it.
The other thing is when they go to Hillel, because they didn't know what to do about the Korban Pesach and their shackles.
And it's Gemara in the beginning of the sixth parashah of Pesachim, where Hillel rebuked them and was a little haughty with the rebuke, and then you forgot what to do if you didn't have the knife with you for the Korban Pesach and Shabbos. So there's a whole collection of examples like that. The one that relates to David, which is not to go down there, by the way, it's just for Moshe, but one of the relates to David is where David holds up Shaul's garment, right? He's holding up the corner, and he says, Shaul, what do I have to do to convince you that I don't want to kill you? If God had tempted me, I would have killed you. So the Gemara Brachos Daf Samach says, Mesita tokoreli? Right? You know, God already... This story is before the one that we're now. That's in Shmuel Aleph. Mesita tokoreli? You call me a temptress? What are you talking about? I'll tempt you, all right. I'm going to make you violate a mitzvah that every young child knows not to violate. What's that one? You get up to it. I don't include it in this book because David is sorely punished for it. I don't need to tell the Bible critics, where the Bible itself tells us David's punishment. For what?
David and Bathsheba?
No. That says it's wrong. No. David didn't have to forget. He knew very well what he was doing, but
He asked Hashem to punish him?
He counted the Israel at the end of the book. He tasks Yoav to count the Israel. The story starts off by saying, by Yoset Hashem, God tempted, he uses the Lashon of David, as if though God says, yeah, I'll tempt you, all right. Just wait and see. And Yoav says, why do you want to do this, David? This is not, you don't need this census. We're not fighting any wars anymore. Just let it be. David insists, and then there's a famine. And David has three choices for punishment. And David's response to the three choices is a prayer that we say every day. We're not going to say it for the next month. Vayomer David el God, Tsar li ma'od, niflon be'el Hashem ki rabim rachamav, uviyad adon al epoga. It's the opening line of Tachanun. Okay? So you see that, you know, have this strain of sources where God shows some kind of anger to David for misspeaking. Okay, but this one is, you call the mitzvah Zmiros? I'll give you a Zmiros. You're going to forget the simple mitzvah of the Torah. That every child knows. Okay. All right, so be it. But then tragedy strikes, because this would not have happened if it was on the shoulder of a man. Irina, please. Hey, David.
Then David called the Mizrachim with Hashem for Atze Roshim, with the Nora, with the Fim Valim, with the Fim Rim Nanim, with Self Selim.
That's quite a symphony. Right? You have wind instruments here, you have string instruments here, you have percussion instruments here. Quite amazing. I think everything falls into this agreement. So tufim is percussion, nanim is percussion, nivolim is string, kinoros is string. Tzatzalim is mistam of percussion, and they say tzatzalim are cymbals. And Roshim is his wind. And wind means you have to blow in it to get the sound. Percussion means you have to bang one thing against another to get the sound. And in other words, you have to manipulate strings to get the sound. Right? Step David had this all set up very nicely. And they're having a good time. The Misachakim. Right? You know what's coming up. Right? The Avoah Goran Nachon. Did you read that song?
I will add Gora Nachon Mishlach Uzzah El Aron Elohim Vayachas Bo Ki Shantim Vavakai.
It's a strange lashon, Vayishlach Uzzah El Aron Elohim. It's how it is, Vayushit Uzzah Yodei Ba'aron. Pushed forth his hand. I'm not giving it to me because it's a terrible, okay, tremendous deal here. But it's very strange that it tells us first what Uzzah did before it tells us. Shall I finish my sentence?
That caused him to do it.
What happened? Why? Why did he do this? Wouldn't it have been a more accurate depiction, or at least a way of telling the story, to tell us first what happened, and then this was Uzzah's reaction to what happened? Are you acknowledging that there's something there? Because Lord knows, whoever tries to explain the next few psukim grasps at straws, including the Yerushalmi that I'm about to share with you. Okay? But before we do the Yerushalmi, we have to do Rashi. Nina, do you have it there? Mm-hmm. Kishamtu
habakar.
Kishamtu
habakar. Ki. Shamtu, Makarve, Nana, Uhu, but then Tardin Yomitan. Ari, Margohi, Toria, no Shamu Tardin, the Nikayado, the Tibur Yada, the Frozen.
Okay, something, you know, accidents happen, it wasn't the person looking after it, the animal doesn't know what's going on, but it's starting to slip. Okay. So, ki shamtu habakar. Shamtu from the lesson of Shemitah. Bakar started to be released from the moorings and the aron began to slip. There's someone walking on the side who is going to react impulsively, no? If I walk past you and I drop something near you, you have impulse. You might just reach out to keep it from dropping, especially if it's something very dear and precious. Okay? And yet, Zahava, what happened?
Was it Zion? ויחר אף השם בעוזה ולעקי בום שם אלוקים על השל וימח שם עם אלון אלוקים.
This breaks new ground that we didn't even hear by Nadav and Avihu. It doesn't say that God was angry with them. Lord knows there's a medrash that gives us 12 different things they did wrong. Avihu Rabbah, Rashi Zacharim. It doesn't say God was angry with them. It just said they crossed a certain line that did to them what God told Moshe in chapter 33 of Shmos. You know what I'm talking about, right? Gilo Yirani Agam B'chai. You crossed some kind of line, the same line that would have happened if a people had crossed over Har Sinai, or you know, many other things like that. Okay? Eliyahu, who has to be protected in a cave with just a pinprick of a hole in the cave so that the light doesn't blind him. And you cross that line so readily? Who are you? If God is angry, right, usually there has to be some kind of an effect of that anger. The effect is he killed him. But what are you angry with? What did he do that any other human would not have done that made God angry? That's the dilemma that everybody deals with. If it had not said Beicharaf, then I'd have an easier time working with this. I'd tell you. Just as I'm sorry. It's a consequence. Sometimes, you know. Chama is really good on this and everything, but she ends up by saying the same. In the end, you disobey at a certain level, and it's a high stakes. We're just human beings. Okay. So Zahra reads Zion, ala shal. Shal is an unusual Hebrew word. It usually means something forgotten.
So
let's read Rashi to Pasuk Zion.
Oh, Rashi. על השקדה שהיה לו בדרוש קל וחומר, נוסעב נעשה בירדים לעצמו לא כמו שהם.
וואו. What's the קל וחומר? Remember, she says so cavalierly. Because we have a tradition that the Aron carried the Kohanim across the Yarden. Have you heard that tradition? Aron grabbed the staves. The Kohanim grabbed the staves, not Levim, Kohanim Dafka, and the Aron quickly lifted itself up, and the four Kohanim. And if the Aron is able to carry its carriers, surely it could carry itself. Wow. What if Uzzah didn't know this Medrash? What if he knew the Medrash and disagreed with it, like Radak on the Pasuk and the Brahmanel on the Pasuk? They quote the source that teaches that the Aron carried the people, and they said, that's not the simple Pshat, what's going on there. Pshat is Pshat. It's not exaggerated. Or what if Uzzah knew the Medrash, agreed with it like Rashi, but just wasn't thinking of it at the time? This is the object of anger? All right? I have to go with Rashi. I have to say, okay, Rashi. I mean, do you have anything else to add to this? Remember, I think I told you, Yushalmi, and the Bavli even can say it also.
Well, he was perhaps a righteous person and a leader, so therefore he's going to be judged more intensely.
Hashem is kichut ha-sa'ara, yeah, the Rosh is like that. That's how we explain what happened to Nadav and Avihu. In my inner circle, and I'm very, very adopted with that. Yushalmi says that Uzzah and his brother Achio were going on quite a long walk from Kiryat Yarim up to Yerushalayim to deliver the Aron. And he, like me, probably drank a lot of tea. and nature called. And there's a big procession and 30,000 people watching. What do you do? Yerushalmi says something that's just incomprehensible from the text. It says he believed himself right there in front of the Aron, hoping that, that no one was looking. And CNN was turning the other way, and the reporters were looking in a different place. And he was able to believe himself right there. Hashem Shemayim, I don't want to stop the procession. I'm going to get off. It's, you know, so we just took care of business right there. Rashi was well aware of that source, I'm sure. He chooses not to mention it. It just shows like a sort of a desperation almost, no? God might be angry with that. That might explain the anger. Would you agree? Did I mention this in biblical narrative? I don't remember. I have in my curriculum, and I think I have it in my Haftorah for Shmini, in my Parsha book, but it was not out yet. It's at the editor right now. So this is you're getting an advanced reading here. Ready? This must have come out in a different course, but Shana is probably not in it because this is the first time I'll be learning. You ever hear of a syndrome called Munchausen syndrome? Okay, good. I'm glad you learned it. You can look it up. There's two different types of syndromes. One is Munchausen's, one is Munchausen's by proxy. Something's coming up there. It's named after a German storyteller. And it manifests itself in different ways. I knew some people who really suffer from this. The worst kind of suffering is in the medical field. Or chas v'shalom, parents who just make their kids sick with everything. They're sure they have cancer, they're sure they have autism, they're sure they're, and they just spend their whole life taking the kid from one specialist to another hospital, to another clinic, to another, and they travel all over the world and because they want the sympathy. That's Munchausen by proxy. Munchausen is when you do it to yourself. It manifests itself with there was a case like this, a volunteer fireman who set like 20 fires before they caught him. And then he goes and helps to put them out. How is he always there for everybody else? What a hero. One really awful case was a nurse, I think it was a male nurse in New Jersey, who somehow after like 25 years, they found out that like too many people in his care are dying. What he was doing is he was changing the regimen of the, you know, there's a drip that comes in for really, really sick people. And he makes the drip come in four times faster than it's supposed to. The guy goes into shock. The doctor's trying to figure out what's going on. And he looks like the drip is coming too fast. And he shuts it, makes low, and he saved them. The whole family gives him a gift and they love him and they, because he saved life. And they're trying to figure out who was the doctor, who ordered it. And they said, no, it was ordered for a quarter of that. Why didn't you do that? And they said, and the blame goes around and around and around. After, this is a long time ago. This is before we had routine surveillance. They finally got started to put surveillance, and they saw it. He was doing it. He lasted years. He killed about 20 people. Who may have died anyway shortly afterwards because they were all very deathly ill, but he was personally responsible for the imminent death of 20 people over the time that they studied it. Okay? It's what you do. You cause a problem to exist so that you can appear to be the hero for saving the day. Now tell me why Pasuk Zion tells us first what he did before the problem exists.
Push the
Aron
to make it.
Now, however Uzzah is, I beg forgive us. I'm very sensitive to explaining biblical characters in ways that these are great biblical characters. The Aron was in his house for 20 years, and who am I to schmitz him this way? All right, but I do it for you, God. I do it because I'm anger? Maybe if he relieved himself. The Yerushalmi has a tradition that that's what he did. Like Ibn Ezra often says, in Kabbalah Mekabel. Ibn Ezra is just not consistent in those Kabbalahs. Right? What makes Ibn Ezra accept some Kabbalahs, which are not Pshat, but reject some other Kabbalahs? Kabbalah means like an ancient tradition. That the woman that Miriam was speaking about that was married to Moshe was none other than Tzipora. Ibn Ezra accepts that. Why? She's called an Isha Kushit. Why don't you say like Rashbam, who says who's an Ethiopian princess? There's even a Medrash that says that. So Ibn Ezra runs into trouble like that because he's not consistent. He doesn't accept that Yocheved was 130 when Moshe was born. He says, I can't accept that. I can't accept that Sarah, there's a big deal about Sarah being 90 and the text is silent over her 130 having three kids. I don't accept it. That's it's on that passage where the Ramban delineates, he's very critical of Ibn Ezra, delineates all the places where why we should accept certain Kabbalos, even though they're not written. And that Nimrod was a bad guy. Ibn Ezra said Nimrod was a tzaddik. So what makes this Kabbalah better than that Kabbalah? Because I get to choose the ones I like. Chazal had a Kabbalah that he relieved himself right in front of the Aron, and that's why God was angry. So, you know, but I'm sort of turning him into a villain. Right? After all, the Aron did not end up falling. You get me? Because I'm very troubled with Vayichara. It's something that got angry. Maybe what I'm doing now is getting God angry. Okay, I'm only doing it for you, Kadosh Baruch Hu, to try to explain what the anger is. And I am basing it on the order of Pasuk Vav, which seems to me out of place. Should say what the problem is first, and then the reaction of Uzzah. Okay? So the terminology that you find in the Torah for what happens if you breach that divide and your throat's bung, a few times the Torah says in Matan Torah, Lashon, pen your throats. Don't make a peretz. There's a divide between the divine and the human, and if you cross that divide, it must kill you. It would even kill Moshe, so don't go there. Okay? Remember we did a few stories in Tanakh where some people behaved with contrition and humility, like Yeshayahu, Shimshon's parents, Gidon, some other people who behaved with insolence. People like Shemesh, Adan Avivu, the Atzilei in Israel, in Parshas Mishpatim. That might be what's going on in Parsha Shmini, is that Moshe and Aaron, the father and the uncle, are both flat on the floor, it says. Straight out on the floor, singing like, what are you doing? Stealing the show. Right? If daddy and the uncle are on the floor, why aren't you on the floor? I rest my case. Right? And they named the place Peretz Uzzah. I'm not familiar with a place of that name today. Okay? And like in Shmuel Aleph, the way the Plishtim kept reacting to the Aron and all the things it did to them, right? So, Pasuk Tes, we not read Tes in Yud. Are you read David?
Vayirad Aviv El Hashem Vayomaru Vayomer Ich Yavoy Lai Aron Hashem לא אהבה דוד בנסיר אליו את ארון השם על עיר דוד, ויתהו דוד בית עובד אדום הגיטי.
This Obed Edom Agit is actually the Levi. He's not an Edomite, and he's not a god. How he gets this name, I'm not going to get into, but he's a very, very well connected and very often mentioned individual in Divrei HaYamim. His name shows up 20 times. I'm not exaggerating. Just every way you turn, when David is building the base of preparing to build the base of Mikdash, he's all over the place. And he's a lady. Okay. Notice that in Vayikra, the tragedy of Nadab and Abihu does not change the celebration in iota. God warns Aaron and Moshe, don't show any outward signs of mourning. This is a celebratory day. We're turned to tragedy, but this is Bayom HaShmini. We have to make everything we can out of this celebration, and the Bayom HaShmini continues. Here, everything stops for 3 months. Okay, and David finds out that during those 3 months, the home household of Obed and Megidim has been profoundly blessed. David says, "Enough already. This Aaron should be with me." Okay? And David continues the procession. Okay. So, read your Gimel quickly, Shana, your Gimel and your Dalet.
Ki tzadu nos Aaron Hashem shisha tzadim v'yizbach shorom rabi. V'david mechar ker v'chol oz levnei Hashem v'david chador evo bad.
Wow. So, Mustafa is David that's doing all this. He's the one slaughtering all the oxen. He's giving out big pieces and legs and giving out the eshpar and giving out pieces. They say that each ox was divided into six and given to different families. Right? And he was mecharker. Whenever you have a Hebrew word that looks like this, like gal, mecharker, it means something again, over and over. It's like Karkar is dancing like a crate, like a spinning top. Right? Okay. And it makes the point that it's Lifnei Hashem. David is an honorable king, but when you're dancing before God, what kind of honor do you have? And he's Chagur Eifod Bad. Hey, wait a second. Chagur Eifod Bad, that's like, is that all he's wearing? All right, let's not go there. But that's usually the clothing of the Kohen Gadol. I don't treat it here. We had that back in Shmuel Aleph. The Kohanim, they were all wearing Eifod. Eifod Bad is only the clothing for Kohen Gadol. Right? Eviatar has the Eifod Bad to tell David what's going to happen. So they were bringing up the Aron this time. It's going to be celebratory. There's no glitches. But look what's happening here. So Haba Bahaya Aron Hashem. And finally made its way to Yerushalayim.
This is your Tetzayim. V'haya Aron Hashem ba Yer David Michal bar Shaul Nishkefa ba'ar ha'chalon v'tireh et ha'melech David mefazeiz v'mechalker v'tanei Hashem v'tidez lo v'libach.
Okay, now there's a slightly different description here, which may be that by now, you know, you dance a lot. If you ever danced in a, maybe at a wedding or something, I have a wedding tonight, I'll see if it happens. The more you dance, the more crazy you get. Right? You don't get tired, no. I could give it, I don't know if you go dance at a Rebbe's dish on Friday night, but you dance like for an hour. And they sing the same song for an hour. I remember a Seder, my Rebbe's Seder, he sang Mekimi Me'afardo, Mekimi, half hour. After like 10 minutes, you're either hypnotized or you're starting to get like kaleidoscope. You're getting crazy, right? But at at some point you just fall into a groove of something. So maybe that after David was dancing for some period, it went from a harker to... Would you just read? Almost a hapax. Nefazeis from a harker. Or, possibly, I think more likely, what does the second pasuk do? It's a very important approach to reading from her perspective. You see it? She is seeing her care, but to her, right, could you imagine Princess Di waving like this at a public gathering? How does Queen Elizabeth wave her hands? A little bit like that. So, but you know, you start to exaggerate things. You know, if Princess Di would do this, that's to Queen Elizabeth. That's like going crazy. So it could be that David was just mecharker, and she's just exaggerating what it is. It's always very funny to hear like something that happened, and then the impression of one person on one side of what happened, the impression of a person on the other side of what happened. Okay, we're gonna table this here. We're gonna continue the Aron on Tuesday. We'll try to finish because we have two pair of Vav and Zion together, so we're gonna try to finish both Brooklyn next week. Right? And then we'll be really an easy street to finish off. Okay, so remember we have so there are three ways that